Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Monday, August 19th. The State of Property Insurance, Commissioner Gordon Ito, just back from a conference. He talks to us about what the governor's emergency order on the condo crisis means for the short and long term. Lots of meetings this week where water will take center stage. Today we hear from Ernie Lau, Honolulu's Board of Water Supply's chief engineer, about his fears about a new class of chemicals that turned up unexpectedly in an IAO well. The Navy expects to field questions about the contaminants at its open house as it details the cleanup effort at its Red Hill Underground facility. And a first in the U.S., we learn about a high school course dedicated to Filipino studies. And we take a closer look at the tools of tattooing. In some cultures, tattoo artists still use bones. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Some point to a crisis in condo land as the reason behind an emergency order that Governor Josh Green signed into law earlier this month. Joining us live today is State Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito. Good morning, Gordon.
Hi, good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, and you just came back from a conference, and, you know, the situation here is that for months now we've been hearing that condo owners, property owners of, you know, wooden structures, that they're seeing huge hikes in what they have to pay in insurance, anywhere from 50% to 500%. So what's happening across the mainland? Did this topic come up at all?
Yes, Catherine, you know, we're in a very extremely hard market right now, and it's not only limited to Hawaii, but also the U.S. and even worldwide to a certain extent. So there has been, you know, lots of discussion on a national level at the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and this has been going on for quite a while, you know, last several years. But the NAIC has been, you know, at the forefront and taking leadership in terms of looking at climate change and global warming and impact on insurance. So it's something that is continually discussed at every national meeting. So that's, you know, again, been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, and so, you know, we're seeing with climate change some pretty wacky weather, and as a result, our storms are more frequent and they're stronger, so they're doing more damage.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's especially in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, the U.S. had, you know, been hit with a number of catastrophic events that caused huge insurance losses in the U.S. as well as, you know, in Hawaii. Unfortunately, you know, with the Maui wildfire event 1 year ago.
Yes, and so the situation then is the governor has just signed this emergency order, and I guess share with our listeners what this does.
Yeah, so what the, you know, the Governor Green has recognized, you know, the crisis that we're encountering, especially in the condo insurance market, and the, you know, unprecedented increase in rates for the AOAO, the HOAs for condo association. And so, you know, Governor Green had called a joint task force, executive and legislative task force in June. We started meeting, the task force started meeting July 1st, and we've been meeting every 2 weeks. On July 22nd, the three co-chairs, Speaker Tsaiki, Senator Keokalola, and myself, we sent a letter to the governor requesting possible issuance of an emergency proclamation, and as a result, to help stabilize the market. The condo market in particular. As a result, you know, the governor did issue an emergency proclamation on August 7th. And what that does, it waives certain statutory provisions that allow the HPIA, Hawaii Property Insurance Association, as well as the Hawaii Hurricane Relief Fund, which has just been reconstituted with the appointment of the board of directors. It waived provisions such as the policy limitations that's in the HHRF law of $750,000, as well as the type of structure that can be covered. Because you have to remember, The Hawaii Hurricane Relief Fund, also referred to as HHRF, was created after Hurricane Iniki and was mainly back then on single-family homes. So, you know, the EP, the Emergency Proclamation, waives provision and allows, if the HHRF is restarted, to potentially cover condominium-associated master policy types of and offer coverages to the condominiums.
And this board has been dormant for 20 years, so you've got new members on board. And if folks want to find out who those members are, I'm told that the information is on the Lieutenant Governor's webpage.
Well, it's actually and it's actually on the Hawaii calendar. They can look on the Hawaii calendar, which I believe is on hawaii.gov, and they can look at the Hawaii Hurricane Relief Fund and look at the agenda, as well as when the meeting minutes are posted, as well as the video of the meeting.
Well, governor signed this order, I'm sure a lot of condo associations were like, okay, where do we sign up? But it's not in place yet. You're still going through this process.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Catherine. I mean, it's not where HHRF could immediately start issuing policies. It is a startup, so the board is starting to meet, looking at whether there is a lack of availability of hurricane coverage. That's one of the initial statutory requirements. And so we're at the very beginning. We're working as quickly as we can to potentially restart the HHRF and provide some relief to the condo association. So it's not where there's an insurer that issues policy now for condo association. I mean, we're in the process of analyzing the market and potentially restarting HHRF to provide options to condo association, provide stability into the market for the market.
Okay, so people need to stand by then, because the structure's not in place yet.
Yeah, but we're working as quickly as we can to make the determination, and if we do determine there's a need, then move forward in restarting HHRF and provide hurricane coverage.
Okay, but I think people are hoping that this is going to kick in before the end of the year.
Well, I can't make any promises. I just can again reiterate that we're working as quickly as possible to see what can we do to provide relief.
And I was wondering about the timing of this order. Did something happen? Did any of the carriers that are writing policies, did they pull back? Has anyone threatened to pull out?
No. The market's been very bad for over a year, 2 years. What caused the problem with the condo market is, you know, May of 2023, a carrier that was writing hurricane master policy put what we call sublimits on the hurricane exposure, and that's the thing that started the cascading effect and making the market in Hawaii even worse for condo association. So it is a problem that still exists, but we're trying to do everything we can to try to address this. And the governor recognizes that, and that's, you know, the emphasis or the basis to kind of kickstart or give us a head start in trying to address the problem for that condo associations are facing at the present time on hurricane risk exposure.
And then the lawmakers did take it up during session earlier this year. I don't know if with this order that, you know, I don't know, I guess this gives you, what, a head start? If something else, if there are other roadblocks that maybe legislation will have to be enacted?
Yeah, I believe there's going to be, going back to the task force, there are recommendations that the task force will come out for the next legislative session, for legislators to consider in the next session. But, you know, again, going back to the EP and the recommendation, is it gives really a head start, because one of the critical items was the $750,000 limitation. And that, by waiving that, allows us, the HHRF, to consider offering condominium master policy on the hurricane exposure.
Okay, so that'll give them more flexibility then with this problem.
Exactly.
Okay, and then we just have to keep our fingers crossed that no storms forming in our area, hit us at this very vulnerable time.
Or even in the U.S., I mean, not only Hawaii, but even the U.S., because there is some stability coming to the insurance reinsurance market where rates aren't going up between 20% to 50% every year. But again, that doesn't equate to rates coming down drastically immediately. It's going to be a long process. What we're doing is trying to provide further stability to the market and address really the large increases, so potentially address some of the large increases that condo associations are facing, you know, as much as you had mentioned, 300% to 500% for wood frame condos, and there's even some condominium associations that have been faced with 1,000% increase over the last year. And so we're trying to address what can we do to, you know, stabilize and mitigate some of the increases.
And, you know, we're hearing that some historic properties on the mainland, particularly wooden structures, are having a difficult time getting insurance, or they're just paying more. You know, we were hearing more recently that townhouses that are made of wood also seeing their prices hike.
Yeah, I mean, the wood frame structures in Hawaii, there's some non-renewals are going on, but it's not a wholesale, you know, pull-out from the market.
But just something to watch.
Yeah, the HHRF will help address that if it's restarted. Also, with respect to the emergency proclamation on the HPIA, Hawaii Property Insurance Associate, it provides flexibility for them to potentially pick up additional on people who can't get insurance or have difficulty in obtaining insurance for homeowners, single-family homes as well as townhomes. So that's something that HPIA is working on.
All right.
Also.
Well, we do appreciate your time and giving us an update because I think lots of residents across the state are very concerned about this issue. But thank you again, Gordon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been hearing from State Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito about the governor's emergency order to try and stabilize the property insurance market.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Telcom, now offering Fioptics Plus TV service statewide, giving Neighbor Island families a choice in TV providers. HawaiianTel.com/Fioptics Plus.
In Israel, news about the war with Hamas shows the trauma of October 7th.
How can you digest what happened and what's happened since?
While news outlets like Al Jazeera focus on the violence inside the Gaza Strip.
They have correspondents there in Gaza, so they are showing the truth.
Opposing views on the war in Gaza, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
The Honolulu Board of Water Supply's chief engineer, Ernie Lau, is worried about what its sampling detected 3 months ago in an Aiea well. That well was shut down 3 years ago as a precaution following the military's fuel spill at its underground facility at Red Hill. Lau thinks the presence of what's called PAHs, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, is more reason why we need to accelerate a plan to understand the flow of water in our aquifer. We talked to Lau and Operations Administrator Erwin Kawata last week.
There's still no agreement on the groundwater flow model, although I think the Navy's going to be submitting something and maybe in September. We have not seen that yet. And also the conceptual site model, there's still discussions about where to put monitor wells in the area. And, you know, these discussions have been going on for years.
Well, you're looking at these test results, these positive test results, as what, a need for some sense of urgency?
I would say, Catherine, that's an understatement. You know, here we are, that occurred in November 2021. Here we are in August of 2024, and now there's these detections, not only in our border water supply Aiea wells, which has been shut down since December of 2021. So none of that water got into our system, fortunately, but we've been still continuing to test it. But it also was detected in that same month of June at a well, a Navy monitor well, just about a half a mile away from our Aiea wells, and on the same side of the Halawa Valley side, you know, on the Aiea side. And they also detected a number of PAH chemicals, some of which are what we also found in our Aiea wells.
And the concern that we have about this new chemical is what exactly?
These chemicals are at different levels, can be very harmful to human health. I'll ask Erwin to explain the possible health effects of some of these chemicals?
Yeah, some of these PAHs can be carcinogenic. Some of them can have other kinds of health effects. So it's important to continue monitoring for these different types of chemicals. These chemicals is actually a class. So these are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. It's really a class of chemicals, different kinds of chemicals that occur naturally in crude oil and other petroleum products. And so for that reason, it's important to monitor and test for these different types of chemicals.
Right. But do we know where they come from specifically?
The fuel products that's being used are all originate from crude oil. So yes, it can be present in various different kinds of petroleum products, including jet fuels, regular gasoline. It can be present in all of those types of products.
Now, I did speak to folks over at the Department of Health and the EPA, and I know they've sent you folks letters about looking at other possible sources besides the fuel spill.
We did receive one letter on August 9th. We sent them a letter on July 8th and got a response back on August 9th, asking us some questions. So we're working on responding to their letter. And it was a joint letter between the Department of Health and EPA.
But what's your sense of that it could be another source besides the Red Hill fuel spill?
Okay, well, let me maybe put things in perspective. Yes, it could be another source, but you know, what do we know about fuel spills in this whole region? We know that in 2014, from tank number 5 at the Red Hill facility, the military claims they lost 27,000 gallons of JP-8 jet fuel, and that leaked out into the environment, got into the groundwater. And then fast forward to 2021, two events in 2021. May 2021, there was a pipeline burst below the fuel tanks in the lower access tunnel, which connects all the tanks to Pearl Harbor. That pipeline burst open near the top of the tank farm, tank 20 and tank 18, and spilled thousands of gallons of fuel into that lower access tunnel. Fast forward then a few months later to November, because some of that fuel from the May event got captured in the drain line for their firefighting foam system in a plastic pipe that broke right above Red Hill Shaft. And in a very short period of time, that fuel contamination was actually in their drinking water source at Red Hill Shaft and being pumped into their water system, to the point that you could actually see fuel floating on the water in their drinking water source. And they also sent Navy divers. So those are three knowns of fuel releases in the area. So if the regulators can point to other potential sources, then I welcome to share that information with us.
I think they raise the question of past uses in that general area, right? We had the IA sugar mill.
Which was closed in the 1940s. So that is a long time ago. And you know what's interesting too, what I can't explain is we've been testing weekly for these PAH chemicals pretty much since the November 2021 incident. You know, shortly thereafter, I think in December or January, we went into weekly testing. And we haven't found it till now, till this year in May and June. Also, in a nearby monitor well, the Navy also in June found quite a number of similar chemicals in their monitor well in the groundwater. So a lot of unexplained things. Yes, we're open to it. But I'd like to also say that this investigation into defining the nature and extent of contamination emanating from Red Hill and perhaps traveling with the groundwater to the west across the lava valley toward our wells in Aya and Halava, that investigation needs to be done ASAP. No more delays on it, because we can't see deep underground what's happening in this underground, in the underground aquifer. And we're just seeing the by samples that we happen to take. So some of the things that can be done immediately, the Navy can now move to weekly testing for different contaminants at all their monitor wells, give a better chance that we might be able to spot things moving in the underground aquifer, because the groundwater is always moving from one point to another. The other thing, too, that I've been asking since January 2023, shortly after the AFFF concentrate spill at added 6 at Red Hill, of about 1,300 gallons of that concentrate liquid, which contains PFAS, is used to make firefighting foam. They need to test for PFAS also on a weekly basis at all monitor well locations immediately. And I've been asking that for over a year and a half now. and not making any progress. But they need to do that immediately.
And right now they only do it, what, monthly?
They do it, I think, monthly, and they only do it at 9 wells. They did do a baseline test in, I think, September of last year. And then what it showed is actually they're detecting PFAS chemicals at multiple locations in their monitor well network, and also some older PFAS chemicals that they couldn't explain. But then more recently, we just learned at a regional advisory board for the Navy for the Superfund site, which is Pearl Harbor, including the Red Hill facility, that they actually started using AFFF firefighting foam systems back into the 60s at Red Hill.
The bottom line, though, is that these chemicals are not in the drinking water. The IAO wells were shut down. Are you concerned that if they keep showing up that you might have to shut off wells?
That is a big concern, Catherine, because just about half a mile to the west of IAO wells is a well that's currently pumping and providing water to the IAO Halawa Committee, or Kaumila wells. And there are more wells further westward from there. So how far is this thing originating from Red Hill? We need to know. Where is it located? It could be multiple plumes. We don't know. The underground geology is very complicated. Will we need to shut down other wells in the future? We're not sure. But if we do that, that means our systems are going to be that much more stressed. We're going to lose some redundancy of well sources in the water system. So we're going to need the cooperation of our customers if we have to go down that road to cut back on their water use, to make sure that demand and supply equal each other, and that we can keep up and meet the demands of the community.
Well, to be honest, the first thing that I thought of when I heard about this was, all the planned development in that area, by the stadium for new homes and all of that.
Okay, so let me put it this way, Catherine. There's a lot of uncertainty here, and you can ask the Navy and DOH and EPA, is contamination moving in the groundwater across Halawa Valley and getting to the west and impacting like our IAO wells? Do they know for sure? And they'll probably tell you they don't know, like we don't know, because there's a lot of uncertainty. What would be the consequences if it indeed was occurring and we actually got it wrong? We were pumping a well and we inadvertently sent these contaminants into the water system, serving that IAO Halawa community or the Honolulu water system. What would the consequences be? We can't get this wrong. The consequences to me would be dire. People have already suffered a lot of trauma. They would be just quite stressed. So we cannot get this wrong. We cannot assume that these contaminants are not moving at this time. I would say until they can prove it otherwise, I'm going to operate on the cautious side here, on the side of protecting people's health.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Board of Water Supply's Chief Engineer Ernie Lau and Deputy Manager Erwin Kawata. Full disclosure, the Board of Water Supply is an HBR underwriter. And this issue is expected to come up at several water-related meetings this week. The Water Commission meets at 9 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, August 20th. Wednesday evening from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., the Navy is holding an open house to update the public on the progress being made to remove the sludge from its empty Red Hill fuel tanks. And on Thursday, the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative Group meets. We will hear from the Navy right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in a variety of ways, including exhibition openings and events at honolulumuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Oscar-nominated actor Anjanue Ellis-Taylor. The star of the movie Origin talks about how she chooses characters that allow her to communicate elements of herself and where she comes from. She stars in the new coming-of-age film, The Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
The Navy's regularly scheduled Red Hill Open House is set for 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday at Wanlua Terrace Community Center. The military is preparing to field questions about a new class of chemicals that it and the Board of Water Supply detected in routine testing earlier this summer. We talked to Joanna Delphin Friday. She's a spokeswoman for the military, about what will be covered at the public meeting and how it plans to handle public concerns.
So we will have our drinking water monitoring team there who can answer any questions about drinking water, and groundwater experts as well, because we know that this is a topic of interest among the community. We will have those subject matter experts there, as well as subject matter experts who are working on preparing the tanks for decommissioning and closure of the facility. So, you know, right now we're in a very important part of that progress. You know, we've ventilated the tanks, we've degassed them. We actually have people going down into the tanks, removing the sludge. And we're in the works right now to prepare for pressure washing. So actually cleaning those tanks and everything like that, getting them ready for, you know, the eventual closure of the facility.
Do you have a sense as to how much sludge has been removed and what remains?
So I can tell you that last month we completed removing the sludge from tanks 7 and 8 at the facility. And we removed around, I want to say 32 gallons. Now, we won't know the actual numbers until we get down into the tanks, open them up, see what's down there, and we can make that actual assessment, right? So the amount of, you know, remnants in those tanks will depend on the assessment that we do before we actually start going down and doing the work that needs to be done.
Okay. All right. So you've removed some sludge from at least two tanks.
Correct.
And we're doing it kind of two tanks at a time?
Yes. Yes.
And then the next step will be then washing down the tanks and getting rid of the sludgy, soupy mess, I guess.
Yes. And speaking of sludge, you know, people are very interested in seeing what the inside of the tank looks like. We have several videos. We have a virtual tour that will actually walk people from the entrance outside of the facility into the tanks and down the tanks as well. And we'll also have a new video of people who have gone down the elevator in the tanks and physically removing the sludge. And on top of that, we will have vials of actual sludge from the facility so people can see what it looks like.
So these are actual workers?
Correct.
That are explaining what this experience is like going
Yes.
in there?
Yes. Yes. And we'll also have a mannequin on site so people can see all the safety precautions that we're taking for these contractors, for these workers who are going down into the tanks. So that'll be, you can see kind of the safety measures that we're taking to ensure that our people are protected.
Have there been any incidents?
No, not to my knowledge. No, things have gone pretty smoothly for the first set of tanks that we went ahead and, you know, we degassed, we ventilated and removed the sludge from it.
So. Is this the first time that you're actually doing then a video?
Yeah, an actual kind of first person point of view. Yes. Yeah. So we actually attached a GoPro to somebody and they were actually able to capture great footage of what it looks like from the bottom of the tank all the way up. And, you know, you can get to see, you know, what these workers see every day, right? What it's like to be down there in the tank and see the sludge and pick it up and transport it and everything like that. So people will get a first person point of view when they see the video at the open house.
And then have we tested the sludge?
The sludge is packaged in a secure container and is sent off for analysis.
Okay. And so it's going through that process now?
Yes.
Okay. So we don't have any results back as to what, as far as you know?
Yeah. As far as I know, I have not seen any results.
Okay. And so what's the schedule? When do you hope to start washing down those tanks? And then what do you do with the water?
Sure. So I can't speak exactly to the schedule right now. We're in kind of that preparation phase right now for pressure washing. Once we wash down the tanks, the water will be released through the four line. It's the fuel oil reclamation line. And then that will be disposed of. And the specifics of that I'm not quite sure of right now, not off the top of my head. But then again, that's a question that you can ask our subject matter experts the day of the open house. So for people who are interested in learning more about the process and the schedule, we'll actually have what we call our integrated master schedule on display so people can see where we're at, where we'll be in a few months, and then where we're going, you know, in the next year or two. We can give you a step-by-step process of exactly how that'll work.
And in the previous open houses that I've attended, I know there is a plan and a tentative schedule, but then some of the work I know has been contingent on the regulators giving you folks the nod that, you know, here's what you hope to do, and does it pass muster, you know, with the EPA and DOH?
That is correct. Our staff works daily with, we keep daily communications with the regulators to ensure that, you know, we remain in compliance with their regulations. Speaking of that, EPA will be at the open house. They'll have a booth as well. And so will the University of Hawaii's Red Hill Health Registry. They will also be there for people who might have questions about it. They can explain that to you and everything. So those are two additional agencies who will be at the open house if people are interested in speaking with them as well.
So there are folks who maybe consume some of this water and are concerned about any health effects. People will be there.
We encourage everyone who has any questions about Navy Closure Task Force operations, from tank closure to drinking water, environmental remediation, to come down and talk to the experts and kind of get that firsthand explanation of everything that we're doing.
Okay. All right. And then when is the next scheduled open house? Do we have another one planned?
So we don't have an exact date yet, but it looks like it'll be around November.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And the open houses are quarterly.
Okay. And this time it's at the Moanalua Terrace Community Center.
Correct. And you know, Moanalua Terrace was one of the affected neighborhoods following the crisis in 2021. So our goal was to actually get out there and connect with the individuals who were affected and let them know that we're here for them, to hear, you know, their thoughts and their concerns as well.
That was the Navy's public affairs spokeswoman, Joanna Delphin, talking to us about the Red Hill Open House meeting on Wednesday. Now, the EPA and the State Health Department has asked the Honolulu Board of Water Supply for additional information about its sampling and that new class of chemicals that it detected. DOH wonders whether those chemicals could have come from other sources besides Red Hill, like the old IAEA sugar mill, as well as runoff from other nearby construction projects. It also questioned that if the contaminants were from Red Hill, why were they not found in the Halaba wells, which are closer to the underground tanks? The military is expected to provide a subject matter expert for us to talk to about the detections in its groundwater monitoring wells and its theory about where they originated. Filipinos make up around 25% of our population, and many of them may not even know their history or culture. Now, many high school students in Farrington and Waipahu High School classrooms have the opportunity to gain that knowledge this fall through the Filipino Curriculum Project. Ray Mart Bilote is the project's co-director. He works as a student teacher at his alma mater to help teach the course. Bilote and the founder Marissa Halagao joined HPR's intern Alyssa Salcedo in our studio recently to talk more about the curriculum that's being rolled out this school year.
The Filipino Curriculum Project is a student-driven organization of Filipino students across Hawaii. And for the past 3 years, we have been collaborating together along with educators to develop a curriculum on Filipino history, culture, and identity to be implemented into Hawaii schools. And that is because we as Filipino students have all recognized that Filipinos are drastically underrepresented in the curriculum that we learn in our education system, despite Filipinos being Hawaii's largest Asian ethnic group. And Filipinos have such a rich history in Hawaii.
It's a collaboration of students from different schools all over Hawaii, Oahu. And the Filipino Curriculum Project is a student-led initiative started in 2021. And fast forward to today, the course Filipino History Culture, CHR 2300, is finally approved by the Hawaii Department of Education and is available for all of Hawaii DOE schools. However, it is not offered to every school, so that is kind of like our main goal now. Our next step is to implement it to as much Hawaii schools as possible.
And I saw that on the website, there were 6 sections of the curriculum, and I think the first one was identity. What does that unit include?
So identity will be woven throughout all the units, and we're trying to incorporate as much as we can from that unit, from the beginning of the school year to the end of school year. And so they're going to be asking so much about like who they are and, you know, what is their position. There's a compelling question where we talked about what makes you you. So there's this one IDM where We talk about, you know, what does being Filipino look like, smell like, sound like, all the five senses basically. And so we're going to doing so much identity making or like identity
cultivation.
Like, yeah, cultivation activities that is geared towards cultivating that identity, that Filipino identity.
In a pedagogical sense, it is apparent that when students' identities are represented, when they're cultivated, when they're encouraged to learn about them, reflect on them, students are much more engaged. And it also shows us that we are a part of history. We are something worthy to be studied. Social studies and history and all these fields aren't just about people that happened in the past. We can reflect on ourselves because when we reflect on the past, we also reflect on how the past influences ourselves. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of these histories that we're learning, for example, Filipinos in Hawaii, we are Filipinos in Hawaii. And students will have like families, ancestors, and stories themselves that can be woven within. Our final unit, our unit 6 is community engagement and civic action. Mm-hmm. And that focuses on what can you do as a student, Filipino student in your community, what issues or topics that you feel passionate about addressing, and how can you use the knowledge and skills that you have, and how can this class support you in helping to make a difference? That's a way to cultivate leadership skills, and it's a way to show them that you can be a part of like change, because we will be learning about a lot of difficult topics, a lot of traumatic events that did happen to our people, which we should be learning that shouldn't be erased, and then kind of making sure that it is part of this empowering path to saying, look, these are things that happen. This is still something that affects us today, like colonialism and oppression are still very much real concepts, but how can we as students, you know, move forward, make a difference?
Mm-hmm. And I guess kind of going into like the reception of like the curriculum so far, how has it been received by students and teachers in Farrington Waipahu High Schools? Because those are these high schools that the mm-hmm. classes will be piloted in or this mm-hmm. upcoming school year.
Yeah, I think with the introduction of this course, we've seen such a surge of Filipino pride that honestly I've never really witnessed before, because hundreds of students have registered for the course. There's now many teachers that are involved and passionate about teaching it. So many students want to join the project now. So many students are excited to be able to take the course in the future, hopefully. But this is something we were talking about earlier today, actually. There is this need or hunger for something like this that has never really been tapped into. But now that we finally have, we cannot go back, because the fact that there's hundreds of students that are so excited or even willing to take Filipino history, culture, I can't think of another. It just is really surreal, and it really shows how significant a Filipino history curriculum is, because we've never had that before. But we have a huge community here in Hawaii. 25% of the population is Filipino. 25% of this population can feel represented now with this course. I mean, I didn't go to Farrington or Waipahu. Rearmark can talk more about that as a Waipahu grad. But it's been so lovely for me to see, because I still remember being a sophomore in high school and questioning why Filipino history was not included in my Asian history class. And now hundreds of students will never have to ask that question in their classroom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see this course in the classroom as a student teacher. I've actually talked to some of the students that are going to be taking the course, and they are really excited to see.
Oh, really? It.
Yes, of course. And a lot of them are local-born Filipinos. And so, yeah, you're right, Marissa, like about the hunger to learn more about their Filipino identity, right? There is definitely a surge in that. And so when I was talking to the students that are going to be taking the course, they're really excited. They're really interested in learning more about themselves and their community, as well as the teachers. Some of the teachers that I talked to during the professional development, Filipino teachers, they're amazed to see that this is actually happening, that this is turning into a reality, because they themselves did not learn so much about their identity, their history, and their culture. And so now that they are teaching the course, it's a space for them to inspire these students and to, you know, learn about themselves as well by having important conversations such as, like, are you ashamed of being a Filipino, right? And why is that, right? So, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm really excited to hear the discussions that are going to come out every class, weaving that identity piece throughout the course. Yeah, I'm just so excited.
My final question is, if there's one thing that you want students, teachers, and the whole community to take away from this curriculum, this course, what would it be and why?
I would say pride. You know, being proud of your identity. You know, that's the main reason why identity is woven throughout the curriculum. And that's why we wanted this in the beginning, right? It's mm-hmm. for us to learn about our identity. And so I would say pride, you know, like hopefully by the end of the course, like they realize how great it is to be Filipino, right? Like they don't have to be ashamed of being Filipino in Hawaii, being Filipino in the United States, or being a Filipino immigrant, like any kind of like Filipino identity. Like, you know, it's something that ultimately we want to happen is for them to find that pride within themselves.
When students say, hey, we want to be represented, that is a form of resistance. It is a form of pride. Mm-hmm. And the whole student aspect of student advocacy really honors a whole legacy of young people, of youth in our history fighting for change. Because when we look at Filipino history, it is filled with movements, it's filled with youth advocacy, even like the Katipunan, for example. The group of revolutionary leaders in the Philippines was predominantly youth. And then the Sakatas too, like Filipino laborers, so many of them were so young and they were fighting for equality and for better rights for themselves. And so we are not the first students to demand for change, and we won't be the last. And I think both of those things are so important to recognize, because we draw on the experiences and the trails blazed by our ancestors to be able to thrive and make space for ourselves. And we will do that so that further generations and our children can also be advocates for a better world.
Yeah, thank you so much for lending your voices. I really appreciate it.
Maraming salamat.
Maraming salamat. Thank you.
That was HPR summer intern Alyssa Salcedo talking to Marissa Halagao and Raymart Bilote from the Filipino Curriculum Project. The hope is to eventually offer this curriculum to other schools. Look for links to more information on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting humorist, author, and comedian Paula Poundstone of the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this Saturday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt-weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was your guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Indigenous tattoo art is seeing a revival, and today HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us to talk about the return to traditional tools in some cultures. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, and you've been playing in the Filipino tattoo waters recently.
I feel like that's actually my beat now nowadays. Just a couple weeks ago, I spent some time with three cultural practitioners and three siblings who received their ancestral hand markings in the North Shore area. And the type of tools that they use is very unique. It's actually made of bone, specifically boar tusks. And bone tools in Filipino culture are actually one of the oldest forms of tools for tattooing that was nearly lost. And I interviewed Lane Wilkin, who helped revive that use of the bone tools. And he was taught by Samoans from Samoa to revive that practice, because they also use boar tusks, specifically, I think, sharpened boar teeth, to be exact, which is really interesting. And he was saying that other cultural practitioners, Natalia Rojas and Piper Abbas, he actually taught them how to use these bone tools. And he spoke about the origins of using these bone tools that he gained and how he gained access to using it.
As far as I know, my school, Atao Living Traditions, we're the only ones that know how to fashion the bone and use the bone. The tools that we use are recreations of some of the oldest archaeological finds in the Philippines, carbon dated approximately 4,000 years old from the Cagayan Valley, taken from burial caves, and that technology, that skill set was lost somewhere along the way. And so for me, when I first was getting my feet wet into this, you know, this role, I actually had considered just taking machine tool needles and strapping them to a stick. But I was very fortunate that members of the Suluape clan, specifically Kione Nunez, took me under his wing and showed me how to make the bone tools again, because they still had the skill set. The Samoans had given it back to the Hawaiians, and the Hawaiians gave it to us. And so, understanding that we all come from a common lineage, that was one of the reasons why they wanted to give us those tools again, so that we could give that blessing back to our people. There are a lot of people out there that want to tap, but they don't have that lineage. And for context, the Suluape clan of Samoa, they're one of the oldest tattooing families in the world, with a lineage of over 3,000 years as practitioners. And so I don't come from an unbroken lineage of tattooists, but my tools do. And the whole purpose of them teaching me was so that it could go back to the Philippines. So I'm kind of like an intermediary working in the Filipino-American community. Pipo is the one that brought it back home.
Interesting. Wow, I did not realize that.
And in Filipino culture, there's only 5 Filipino culture practitioners who can do this work with bone materials. And even though tapping has seen a revitalization, we look at the Butbut people of Kalinga, which is where Apawang Ode, the oldest indigenous tattoo artist in the Philippines, they have an abundance of thorns, so they prefer to use thorn when they're tapping. And then if you look at like other regions, whether in the Philippines or the Pacific Islands, they'll either use metal or bamboo sticks or what other organic elements they could use. Boar tusk is kind of like one of those interesting things to use. I am looking at a future story about how the DOH will consider boar tusks for health risk or whatnot.
Yeah, because usually you think of tattoo artists and you think of needles, right? Stainless steel needles, and those have to be sterilized. But yeah, I'm just curious if there are other quality control regulations that they have to follow because it's organic material.
Exactly. And especially when we look at, like you said, sterilizing metal and needles instead, boar tusks, I still need to do a little bit more research on that and reaching out to the DOH for a future story. But it's the fact of preserving this culture and helping other Filipinos in the diaspora reconnect with it through tattooing is kind of their own journey to reconnect with their culture. But because there's only few Filipino culture practitioners who use bone material, there's a lot of pressure that Lane Wilkins said in an interview that he feels to preserve this art form since it was passed down to, from his mentor from Samoa. And he said before it was very lonely for him to actually tattoo out in the diaspora until he taught the other culture practitioners, Natalia Rojas and Piper Abbas. And Piper Abbas is actually the only Filipino cultural practitioner in the Philippines who uses bone material. Everyone else uses either bamboo sticks or thorn. But there's a difference between how they use the tapping techniques. They said it's indescribable and it's kind of hard. For me personally, I've never been tapped before, so I don't really know the difference between using thorn or using boar tusks. But Natalia Rojas is one of the few female cultural practitioners that actually perform this work, and she will try to go into detail on this.
Specifically in a woman's point of view, and having have met like other women practitioners, and even looking up to our eldest practitioner, Apawang Ode, in which they use thorn. And there's like a people in Manong Lane have said is like there's a very specific skill set to this, and it just hits different. Like it's one of those things, like it's either to receive markings with a bone tool and using it, it's one of those indescribable things. Like, it's one of those moments, as you know, the newer generations would say, is like, when you know, you know. Like, that's the only thing that is best to describe it. And it, when you're in the space, you'll know. When you're receiving it, you'll know. When you're the one who's marking the skin and bringing back those markings to, giving the markings back to those people that seek it out and that is rightfully theirs, then that's when you know.
And so when I also spend time with the three siblings, Leilani and John Manglona, they've received their chess pieces a couple weeks before together, but they included their half-sibling, Nani Marcos, to also be a part of this ceremony. And for the first time, they even included their mother. And in lots of other cultures, but specifically Filipino culture, having tattoos nowadays is very taboo and very forbidden because a lot of Filipinos, they're either mostly Catholic or Christian. So in that faith, normally it's frowned upon to receive any type of tattoos. So the siblings told me that for a while they hid their tattoos from their family, but until they recently told their mother, like, hey, we have something to tell you. We have these tattoos, but here's what it means. It's to signify like our family heritage, our lineage to the Philippines. And surprisingly, their mother was more accepting. When I told my grandparents that I had tattoos, they said that's that's a no-no. Mm-hmm. But it really does depend on the family. But just to receive that type of tapping, it's pretty rare now. Well, at least in Hawaii, from what I know, because you normally see more machine guns rather than the tapping. But we also see like Hawaiian tapping, Filipino tapping and whatnot. But each of their hand markings, they were gracious enough to share with me what it means. So either it means healing or whatnot, or protecting them on their journey. But this is what Nani Marcos had to say about what her tattoo means.
My parents were both born in the Philippines, and that was their home until they were very young and they moved here. And my dad passed away in 2019. So this ceremony, I was welcoming him into the space to reconnect and hopefully re-strengthen our relationship so that he can continue to guide me.
Yeah, very personal connection there.
Yeah, but I think for Lane Wilkin, his ultimate goal is to help preserve the tapping tools, especially with bone material.
All right, well, thank you so much for sharing this side of tattooing that I didn't know about. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio about tattoo art. You can check out her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at plans for modular housing on Maui. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Google, Spotify, or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.